You've just tuned into Beyond Your Past, part of the Mental Health News Radio Network. Welcome back to Beyond Your Past, the podcast that focuses on inspiring you to move forward from what's been holding you back in life. Each week, we talk with clinicians, coaches, mental health advocates, and those who've overcome tremendous odds and now use their journey to encourage you throughout yours. I'm Matt Pappas, certified coach and NLP master practitioner, alongside Joanne Suppressi, author, certified coach, and hypnotherapist. In addition to talking with amazing guests on the show, we share practical tips and insightful strategies that empower and encourage you to break free from anxiety, self-doubt, and the negative mindsets that keep you stuck. This is your place to feel validated and encouraged as you take your life back and live free from your past. Greetings, friend, and welcome back to the podcast. Before we get started, we'd like to take a second and thank a couple of incredible organizations. INLP Center, offering world-class online neuro-linguistic programming and life coach training to people in over 70 countries. If you've ever considered becoming a coach or simply want more information on their programs, just head over to inlpcenter.org. And to Daily Recovery Support, interactive, daily, group calls in a safe atmosphere for survivors of complex trauma, equipping you with the skills and information you can use every single day in your healing journey. Learn more about this affordable resource and get signed up at cptsdfoundation.org. And because you're a listener of Beyond Your Past Radio, when you check out, use the promo code Beyond Your Past, that's all one word, Beyond Your Past, and receive 50% off your first month's membership fee. I'll put that link in the show notes so you can check it out. And again, that's Beyond Your Past promo code at checkout. And a special thank you to you. We appreciate you listening to the podcast and making us part of your weekly playlist. You all are the reason we do this show, and we wouldn't be here without you. If you enjoy these podcasts, please consider sharing this episode with one person who might find it helpful, and maybe leaving us a review on your favorite podcast app. That would be awesome, and we would definitely appreciate it. If you'd like to help support this podcast for as little as 99 cents per month, just head over to beyondyourpastradio.com and click on the support link at the top of the page. Your generous support of any amount helps us to continue bringing you new episodes every single week. So today we're joined by Lisa Boucher. Lisa is an award-winning author of several books, including Raising the Bottom, Making Mindful Choices in a Drinking Culture. Lisa joins us to discuss her story of overcoming childhood trauma, which included a mother who struggled with alcohol addiction and a father who was verbally and at times physically abusive. She reflects on how these events affected her and led her down a path of her own struggles with alcohol addiction. We talk about the circumstances which led to her deciding to figure out a way to get help and end the addiction that ruled her life for so many years. Lisa shares how so much of her life was lived in chaos, and in order to perpetuate that life, the only life she knew, she had turned to alcohol. We also discuss the one magic ingredient that is needed in order to begin recovery, and Lisa shares how you only need just a tiny bit of it to get started. We talk about the ACEs study, Adverse Childhood Experiences, and the correlation between childhood trauma and addiction. We also discuss how in society today, the media glorifies the use of alcohol as a primary means of letting loose, having fun, or winding down. And this type of message can have a dramatic effect on a young child or young adult who's already struggling in an unsafe home environment. All this and more during our inspiring chat with Lisa Boucher, starting right now. So, hey, Lisa, welcome to Beyond Your Past. It's Matt and Joanne. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me, you two.
It is an extreme pleasure for us to have you here on the podcast. We're excited to learn more about you, learn more about trauma and addiction, the work you do, and all that great stuff. But before we get underway, if you want to take a second to say hello to everybody and introduce yourself, that would be great.
Hi, everyone. As he said, I'm Lisa Boucher. I'm the award-winning author of Raising the Bottom, Making Mindful Choices in a Drinking Culture. I'm also a registered nurse. I've been in healthcare. Let's say I worked in emergency rooms and psych wards, so I've seen a lot. And I've been sober 30 years. So my focus is on people not having to hit these horribly low bottoms. We hear a lot about the opioids, but we don't talk much about alcohol. And that's usually where, for most of us, addiction begins with alcohol.
So tell us about, you said 30 years ago, you recovered from from alcohol addiction. Is that correct?
Right. That's correct. I got sober in my late 20s, which most people don't do. They wait for a couple more decades until they have a whole lot more collateral damage. And I chose not to do that. I was raised with an alcoholic mother who did hit a lower bottom. She did try to find help, but she did not get the right kind of help. And so when I saw what happened for her is they, meaning the medical community, therapists, doctors, hospitals, psych wards, they threw medication at her and she continued to spiral down and down and was really incapable of functioning for a lot of years. There were probably about 4 or 5 years where she really could barely function. And my mother was also a registered nurse. So it was a very hard thing to watch. It created a lot of havoc and pandemonium in the family, as anyone can imagine. Some of it was tragic. Some of it was comical. I mean, it was just a montage of absolute mayhem. So she finally, when a doctor who was also in recovery after my mother had an accident at home, fell down the steps and broke her neck, this doctor finally understood that what she was dealing with was not someone who was manic depressive or any other mental health diagnosis that my mother had been slapped with, but she was dealing with an alcoholic. And so they put her in rehab and my mother found amazing recovery. She was sober 30 years before she died in 2011. So as a result of watching all of this go on with her, and she, like I said, she sobered up. So in my late 20s, when my drinking started to escalate to where I felt it was not normal, I think we know, like people say, well, they don't know. Well, yes, you do. I think we intuitively know when we're getting into that danger zone. And I decided at some point, probably 2 years after that little voice in my head was saying, maybe you're drinking too much, I decided to get sober. And my mom at the time was 7 years sober. And I had seen her change and morph into this amazing person who we hadn't seen in a long, long time because of her addiction. So it was really, I decided I don't want to go the route that she did. And that's when I just decided to address it sooner than later. And it's been a huge blessing in my life. I mean, there's so many things that did not happen. I got sober, Joanna Matt, when most people would never consider it. I was not a daily drinker. I did not have a DUI. I did not really have any major consequences. Yeah, I'd been fired from a few jobs, but you can always rationalize that, you know, crappy boss, whatever. I was married to a professional. We're still married. He didn't think I had a problem. In fact, he was kind of horrified when I pretty much one day said, I'm getting sober. I think I'm an alcoholic. And he was like, no, you're not an alcoholic. I think you just have emotional problems. And I'm like, look, dude, I have emotional problems because alcohol, when I ingest it, it makes me into another person. I cannot predict how I will act. I might be laughing in the life of the party, or I might be full of rage or dissolve into a crying fit. I mean, you just really never knew what you were going to get. And I knew enough about alcoholism. And of course, my mother was chirping in my ear a little bit that I knew it was the drinking. It wasn't some emotional problem. And I could have went that route. And I'm grateful and thank God I didn't, because I see a lot of people working in healthcare still that they have some of those symptoms of their life just never feeling okay. They feel depressed. They feel anxious, all of these things, but they're related to an underlying issue of substance abuse. Sadly, the doctors don't ever really address that. What they do is they prescribe an antidepressant, or they just prescribe an anti-anxiety med, which are benzos such as Ativan, Xanax, Valium. These are highly addictive drugs that most people that end up taking them end up staying on them for years because they get addicted. And then to wean off of them, the withdrawal is agonizing. Some people, you can have a seizure. You can't just stop taking them. Or people have such rebound anxiety that they just, it's too painful. They don't want to deal with it. So I'm very grateful that I didn't go that route. I'm sure you might hear people, you know, where they're caught up in the medication trail. And it's just, it's really, I'm glad that wasn't pushed when I got sober.
Yeah. We do hear that a lot. And you know, I personally worked with a lot of clients who were recovering from alcoholism, and they did go that route, you know, before they met me. So, I do understand, you know, how this process works from listening to their stories and now hearing your story. I am very curious to know, how did you, were you able to overcome your alcohol addiction? Like, what steps did you take that can maybe help other people not go those other routes?
Well, I always say there is one magic ingredient, and it's the hardest ingredient to grasp, and that is self-honesty. So the recovery process starts when you decide, I have a problem. And for some people, that never comes. I mean, they do hit these low bottoms, and then maybe a family member will literally take them to a rehab. And sometimes that works, and sometimes even that doesn't work because rehabs, they can't make you stay there. I mean, I've had people that have been horrible alcoholics and horrible places in their addiction, and they've gone to rehab and they've left halfway through, or they went to rehab just to get everybody to be quiet and not bother them. And then as soon as they were out, they started using again. So I think the one ingredient that we have to have at some level, even if it's just a, like they say, a mustard seed, like a grain of sand, but we have to have some self-honesty that I've got a problem and I want to change. And I was just done with not feeling okay in my own skin. That was just enough of a catalyst. I had been in and out of college for like a decade, still hadn't finished my degree. That's how my addiction was manifesting. Because like I said, I was still very early in it. And you can get away and make a lot of excuses, but I just didn't want to go that route. I didn't want to end up like my mother did. So I decided I've got a problem. And like I said, my mom was 7 years sober at the time. I called her up. She was getting sober with the 12 steps. And I called her and said, I think I have a problem and I'm going to come home. So I talked a lot about it in my book, how when I go home, you know, she's got her posse of friends and her crew, and they're all surrounding me and chirping in my ear, and we're going to meetings and talking, and it's all great. And I do this for about 10 days. My mom was in Youngstown. I live in Dayton. And I said, look, I don't live here. This is great, but I need to go home and find my a sober crew there and try sobriety there. And I mean, at this point, this was like April of 1989. And so I'm not 100% sold on recovery. I want to be sober, but like so many of us will do, we want to be sober. And then when the reality of what it takes to stay sober sets in, it's like, okay, I don't think I want to do this. So I'm having second thoughts about all of it. I'm sober a couple months, and I did have a one-day relapse after I was sober that couple months. And so my sobriety date is June 22nd, 1989. But it was after that one day relapse when I realized I got very drunk on a bottle of wine and I think some beers, which wasn't that much alcohol, but it just really hit me hard. And I was sick. And I thought, like, the light bulb in my head went off, like, why am I doing this? It's really not fun anymore. The lies that I've been telling myself that, well, I won't have any fun and what am I going to do and all that nonsense. It just, I don't know. I think I was just blessed maybe that I was willing to be done. I could have fought it. I could have kept drinking. And like I said, another decade or two and had a lot more probably a couple more marriages. I mean, I already had one marriage that was done. I was married very early at 19, divorced by the time I was 21. Looking back, I needed a roommate more than I wanted a husband. He was a raging alcoholic, crazier than I was, drank more than my mother did, if that was even possible. So it was just why I went from one mess to the next. But that's something we do when, you know, it wasn't until recovery I could look back and say, okay, well, this makes sense. I had this crazy, somewhat traumatic childhood with my mother's alcoholism and then my father, how that inflamed him. So he became a very rageful man, somewhat verbally abusive, physically abusive at times. And I think a lot of it was his behavior was so crazed as a result of the lack of control over my mother's alcoholism. Because like I said, they did try to find help, but nothing was working and it was just getting worse and worse. And I have two older siblings and a younger brother. So there's four of us and we're all just running amok. I mean, the family is just in utter chaos 24/7. So when I left, when I graduated high school, 2 days later, I moved out, but I was very used to chaos. So I ended up creating a lot of my own chaos with that early marriage, with marrying an alcoholic, as much as there were red flags that this man was completely unstable. I chose to ignore them because I didn't want to move back home. And I just wasn't in a financial place to support myself without a roommate. My roommate had come home and said she was getting married. So I was like, okay, what do I do? Oh, meet a guy. And 2 months later, we get married. So it's that kind of thing. And these stories are very common in people's lives that are riddled with addiction in one way or another, whether they were raised with it or whatever. But we get so used to that chaos and then the trauma and just all of that instability can fuel drinking. So it's this vicious cycle kind of thing. And I decided when I got married after that first marriage, 3 years later, I get engaged to the man that I'm currently with. And we had some of our own dysfunction because early in our marriage, there was a lot of movings and we moved to Texas. And then I became a flight attendant and a hairdresser. And I've got all these careers. And the first year of our marriage, where it was like one big date. And we're flying around and meeting in different cities. And it's just fun. But here again, I've got the chaos, a modicum of chaos that feels very comfortable for me. And so although I'm drinking, I'm not drinking, I don't think, alcoholically yet. It's a very huge part of my life, alcohol is. And maybe I'm in the, you know, alcoholism is on a bell curve, as you probably know. So maybe I'm somewhere still on the lower end of this bell curve, and I might be sliding into alcohol dependence or misuse, but I'm not really into alcoholism yet. And so I believe I crossed that imaginary line into alcoholism when we moved from Texas back to Ohio. And I ended up getting back into my marketing job, which was 9 to 5. And that is when I just could not adjust to a normal life. There was no more flying. There was no more fun. With my husband's brother had passed suddenly, and that's what initiated the move back to the Midwest. And so that's when I started drinking, I think, more alcoholically, found a home bar, spent a lot of time in that home bar, started drinking at lunch. So, you know, the progression of alcoholism was starting to emerge in my life. And that's what it looked like for me.
I have so many questions, but one of the ones I wanted to kind of double back on a little bit, and you mentioned about trauma and how it relates to addiction, and the research is there now, especially in this modern age, where there is definitely a direct correlation between childhood trauma and all different types of addictions. So if you want to maybe talk about that for a little bit in terms of your experience and the ways that you feel trauma.
Oh my gosh, yeah, absolutely, Matt. You know, Dr. Folletti is the one who initiated the ACE study that you're probably familiar with. And it talks about, he was the doctor who created the study, and they decided to, instead of asking what is wrong with people when they come into the doctor, he started to ask what happened to you, because he was dealing with people with obesity, perhaps addiction issues, depression, whatnot. And he found through this study that a lot of these physical and mental health issues were related to past childhood trauma. And so I was very relieved to learn about this, and it helped me to understand. And it makes so much sense, because then I was able to look back at my past, that why did I start drinking beer at 12 years old? Well, two reasons. I had two older sisters. But also, when you're in this environment, I can remember the predominant emotion that I felt as a child was fear. So when I found beer, and all of a sudden, I feel different. And I'm not scared. I'm not as scared. I like that feeling. And so this is what happens. And working in mental health with children coming to the hospital with suicidal ideation, and that's what most of them get admitted for. But in overwhelmingly their backgrounds, oh my gosh, some of them have horrific trauma. Some of them not so much, maybe like I did, but we don't know a person's breaking point. Just because I wasn't sexually abused doesn't mean I wasn't as impacted with the abuse and the neglect and the chaos in my environment. So regardless, there's children who, we're going to have a whole new generation of kids who are going to have trauma that we've not had before. So in addition to the common sexual abuse, which is mind-blowing to me, and I didn't realize until I became a nurse how ubiquitous that is. And I would like to know, what is the sickness in our society that compels people to prey on children like that? And I know they say it's learned behavior, but we have to stop this. It's just perpetuating more addiction. But we've got kids that have experienced that. We are now having a generation of kids, because of the opioid epidemic, who are going to be the first that they will be in kindergarten, and they're going to have peers where both parents have overdosed and died. How traumatic. So these children are not only having to experience death at a young age of a parent, but there's too many that have had both parents overdose and die. We also have children who are abandoned because of the drug epidemic. So they've had parents who have abandoned them. We will also have children who have one parent that overdosed, and maybe the other parent is incarcerated because of the opioid epidemic. So this is a whole new level of trauma. And also, we've got many children who they're in more and more in foster homes, and now we have a shortage of foster homes. And I believe there's always been a shortage of good foster homes, because I've seen it with my own eyes. We have people that are foster parents that, number one, many are too old, and they're doing it to supplement their incomes. And I don't know, Joanne or Matt, if you guys have children, but it takes a lot of energy and a lot more than housing and food to raise a child. So it's an enormous investment of time and energy and resources to raise a good kid in today's world, who is going to be equipped with coping skills to go out and navigate life in a healthy manner. So these children are not getting that. They might be getting food and clothing, but they're not getting the skills that they need. I am so disheartened at the number of children who are 13, 14, 15 that I've had in front of me that cannot tell time on an analog clock. They're so used to only digital. Or their reading skills are embarrassingly inadequate. They read at a third grade level, maybe, and they're 14, 15. How are they going to fill out an application? How are they going to navigate life when they can barely read? These sorts of things contribute. I mean, these kids have been traumatized. Now they're not getting educated properly. Now they're not getting their needs met. How are they not going to be the future addicts of America? And why are we not doing more about this? Do you see what I'm saying? We're really just nurturing a new generation of addicts and alcoholics.
Yeah. And for anybody who is not familiar, the ACEs study that Lisa's talking about, if you just Google ACEs study or adverse childhood experiences, there's a lot of information on there. There are websites. There's an ACEs test where you can see what your score is. And of course, as you mentioned too, it's not just based on childhood sexual abuse. It's all different types of childhood trauma. If you have experienced something as a child, you could potentially be affected by this, obviously long-term, which is, as we know, and it's always great whenever we can talk about this because the ACEs study is so important. And especially, you know, as you're mentioning this day and age with the epidemics, running so much right now that these kids are going to start having their own kids. And then, you know, those kids may not have their parents when they go to school and they're not going to have healthy coping skills modeled for them. And they could be ending up in a foster care system any number of things that can go wrong as a result of childhood trauma and then kind of being behind the eight ball after that. So it's always great whenever we can talk about it.
Yeah. And I'm glad. And I apologize for not being more clear on the ACE study, but there's also within the ACE study, it said 89% of adults have at least one adverse childhood experience that can have a lasting effect on them. So this is even another reason why parents need to get it together. And the drinking culture that everyone thinks is so funny and supports and encourages, it's like, what are we doing? You know, I asked that in the book. What are we doing? Do we know? Is this who we want to be, these party parents, so that our children really don't have the skills they need so that they can live healthy adult lives and not turn to substances to help them cope with their feelings, with their disappointments, with whatever life throws. I mean, we all know life throws curveballs and we've got to learn how to deal with them in a healthy manner. And too many people don't have those coping skills. They use alcohol, drugs, food, sex, some unhealthy way to self-medicate their feelings. And it's backfiring big time on all of us because we're all paying the price for in cost. I mean, employers are paying in the cost with mental health problems, with the billions of dollars in lost productivity for people that have alcohol and drug issues. So it's no small matter, but there is such a disconnect in our society and in our culture, the way we encourage alcohol, and we've almost normalized alcoholism with our paint and sip, yoga and wine, with people who, if you, especially adults, if you say you go somewhere and you turn down you say no thank you to a beverage, you get 20 questions of why aren't you drinking? Whereas if you're diabetic and you turn down a cupcake, does anybody question you? No. So why are we pressuring other people to drink with us? And that answer is usually because people who drink heavily are very uncomfortable with people that don't drink because it holds that mirror up. And I just want to say, if you're uncomfortable with others not drinking, maybe this could be a small warning sign or a way for people to start their own journey of health and wellness and look at their relationship with alcohol. That why does that bother you? And maybe do what I did and find that self-honesty and change your life before it turns into a big mess and you're losing your marriage and your kids are traumatized and you've lost your job and all of these consequences, that we don't have to That is my message. We don't have to have horrible consequences before we rethink the drink and maybe look at changing, making some really positive changes in our lives.
Yeah, Lisa, I think the topic about, you know, culture and encouraging drinking is so important, and that you were just talking about, you know, like there's like whenever I watch movies or TV, which is rare, but when I do, it's like they always include scenes where, you know, they have to celebrate with a drink, or they, you know, go out with a drink, you know, just having a conversation over a drink, having a drink in the office, you know, like they have it underneath their desk. You know, so there's always alcohol. And, you know, I do have two children, and I see them watching this, and I'm like, I can only imagine what it's
Joanne, you know, it's outrageous. It's outrageous. Yeah. I mean, you can't watch HGTV. I tweet them all the time. It's like people are making the most, a huge decision, a financial decision on buying a house, and they always have to go to the bar to talk about it with the wine. All the family pictures, when, you know, after they get the house and they're all on the deck, it's always about the alcohol. And it's like they're trying to promote a family home with the alcohol. It is so sad. And just, I was on a radio show earlier, just a couple hours ago, with a guy from Cleveland, Louie, and we were talking about with the sporting events that we're getting into the fall, Pee Wee football. My sons were both Division I athletes, so they were in sports from the time they were young, and the drinking amongst the parents was shameful. The fights that we see all over social media with the coaches and the referees and the whatnot, I guarantee you that is 99.9% alcohol fueled. And that's why those parents are behaving the way they're behaving, because they're a six pack in before they come to the game. And I just say, like, why is this okay? Why do we encourage all this drinking with parents sitting on the sidelines with their solo cups when these kids are in Pee Wee football, or even when high school football, the pre-gaming of the parents that were sneaking alcohol into the games? Like, what is this nonsense? And then in the same next breath, you want to tell these teenagers, don't drink and drive, and don't drink until you're 21. It's a joke. It's a joke. These kids aren't stupid. They see what their parents have been role modeling from the time they've been 9 months old and opened their eyes. And it's just a joke. Where's the parents' credibility? And like I say, you know, kids aren't going to unsee you acting the fool. So,
yeah, you know, right? What they say kids, you know, don't listen to what you say. They listen to what they see you do. You know,
exactly.
So they follow your example versus, you know, instead of your words. But you know, this has been a really great conversation so far. But before we wrap up, I want to hear about your book. So, Raising the Bottom. Can you tell us why did you write Raising the Bottom, and tell us a little bit about the book?
Well, absolutely. So I wrote it because, like I said, I want people to see what there's 10 other stories in addition to mine in the back. And I wanted to show people what that you don't have to hit these horrible bottoms, number one. Number two, I wanted to give children a voice. I care very much about children. And so I did a chapter, What Your Kids Say About You and Your Drinking. And I have a couple letters from two physicians' daughters. Like the people in my book, these are doctors and nurses and hairdressers, and you know, they're just your average people that you're seeing out in the world. And so I wanted the kids to tell us how they feel. And it's very eye-opening when one of the physician's daughters, how her mom's drinking was impacting her. And this is a surgeon who thought she was doing everything fine, and she would go to work and operate on people and come home and open a bottle of wine and cook dinner and drink the rest of the night. Well, her kids were becoming devastated by this drinking. So I did a chapter to them. I did also a chapter to doctors, nurses, and healthcare, because as I said, I am disgusted with the way doctors throw medication at people and who have underlying substance abuse instead of steering them toward recovery where they could find some real help and change their lives. I also, like I said, the earlier part of the book, it's rather comical. with the montage of insanity. So it's memoirish in what was going on in my family and why I did have a higher bottom. And then I talk about, like I said, there are the 10 stories. So I have a socialite, Washington, D.C. socialite. I have a chapter, Nadia, Nebraska. And this is a Nebraska farm girl and how it was for her. I have another chapter, Babies and Booze. And this is a physician who passed out breastfeeding her fourth child with her drinking. So it is eye-opening, and my hope was that there would be a story for everyone. It is geared, there's more women in the book. There are some men, but I tell you, men love it. I just had a guy tweet me. He lives in France, and he loves it. In fact, he specifically really loved chapter 6 and 7, he said they were brilliant, were his words. He said it was just brilliant. So I love that it's helping men and women, and that, you know, the chapters are engaging. I'm supposed to be happy, so why am I crying? That was one of the ones that he thought was so brilliant. So it is a book about what addiction could look like before it all falls apart. And what people can do, I use the 12 steps. I think they've been magical, and I've not seen anything really change a life the way they can. And I'm not going to apologize for appreciating the 12 steps. It is a very much a book of hope that you don't have to hit a low bottom. And I'm just really grateful for, women are, and people are contacting me on social media, like people that they've read the book a year and a half ago, it planted the seed, and now they contact me and say, I finally jumped into recovery, you know, because it's something that doesn't happen overnight for a lot of us. We need to, there's still this initial shame, like I'm an alcoholic, why can't I stop drinking? I mean, all of that is so... Oh, I wish I could say, stop it. Don't do that. But I did. I mean, initially I felt bad. I'm embarrassed. But once you really get into recovery and you realize, oh, I wasted time with that because there's nothing to be ashamed about. In fact, be proud of it. People are not ashamed of having some other medical disease. This is no different. We don't need to be ashamed of it. The only shame of addiction is not addressing it and not taking care of it and living a life of just destruction and self-loathing. That's the shame. There is no shame in recovery. So I think Raising the Bottom makes that clear. It's a book of hope.
It's a perfect way to wrap up this podcast. There is no shame in recovery. That is exactly right. That is amazing. Lisa, all the information you've shared is incredible. Your passion is evidence. Where can people find you on the web, your book, all that good stuff?
I am at raisingthebottom.com. The book is available pretty much anywhere books are sold, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, iTunes. It's also an Audible. If you're not someone who likes to read, I'm also on Facebook and Twitter, Instagram at L. Boucher Author. And like I said, I'm on Facebook at, I think just under my own name, award-winning author, Lisa Boucher. So come find me, join me, follow me. And it's a ride. And I'm here to help you. If you're struggling, reach out. I'm happy to do what I can to help whoever is serious about getting sober. And even if you're not completely serious, but you're just on the fence, that's okay too. Because like I said, there's a lot of people that it's taken them a year and a half, and now they're jumping into recovery. But you just got to stay. I'm open. I'm open to anyone who is open to rethinking the drink.
Your story is inspiring. Your healing is inspiring. Your message is inspiring. Thanks so much, Lisa, for joining us. I hope that this message reaches everyone with the power of hope and healing that you've been able to see and in your own life and in the lives of people you work with, and hopefully the lives of people who are reading your book, that they will know that there is hope, that there is recovery, that there's healing outside of alcohol. So thanks again, Lisa. It was an amazing conversation.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. You guys have a great day.
You too, Lisa. Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Beyond Your Past, part of the Mental Health News Radio Network. Information shared on this podcast is for educational and informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should supersede the direction of a medical doctor or any mental health professional. If you enjoy this podcast, please subscribe on your favorite podcasting app and leave us a review. We would sure appreciate it. Also, please consider sharing this episode with someone who may find it helpful. If you would like more information on working with Matt as your coach, just head over to beyondyourpast.com and schedule your free one-hour chat. If you'd like to learn more about working with Joanne as your coach, please check out joannesuppressi.com and contact her for more information. We're always on the lookout for new guests. If you're interested in joining us on an upcoming episode, just head over to beyondyourpastradio.com and contact us. We'd love to hear from you. Talk to you soon.